Did you lower the mic for me? It's perfect.
Yeah. Oh, well. I've been silently convinced that the main reason Sean chose me to introduce him is that I've got nearly an Irish a name as he has. And although I haven't dared confess my Protestant upbringing, there was a Wednesday night not too long ago where I downed several pints of Guinness in front of him in hopes of proving something. The first few months I knew him, I couldn't make up my mind about Sean. One of only two men in an otherwise lady-charged workshop, he seemed so grumpy at first, always leaning back in his chair, looking vaguely smug. He once offered me a cigarette and said my latest workshop submission was a bad story with good writing. I hated him for a bit, but damn it, he was right. And I've waited until now to admit it in front of him, but Sean is right about a lot of things. This semester, we've begun crossing paths on the regular as we've both been lucky enough to teach Monday, Wednesday, Friday 2135 classes, and Sean has caught me on the inevitable up and down swings of my first semester teaching and provided me with a specific brand of mentorship. First, he will listen to your problem at hand. Then he will offer the simplest and toughest advice. Then he will make fun of you, usually in tones as sarcastic as they are sweet. This Taui methodology, the voice of a good friend, has proven to be a stabilizing influence on my sanity this semester. And that is part of Sean's magic. There's no bullshit in what he says, no forced sensitivity or pleasantry. We can blame it on the 4 years he has spent in a not-so-distant past training to be a Jesuit priest. We can blame it on those broken vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. We can blame it on his time in the Midwest, during which he met and fell in love with a Midwestern woman whose greatest sense of urgency comes through only when singing Nelly at house parties. Or we can just blame it on the Irish. I like Sean's simple contradictions, a sort of raw understanding that fits neither life nor self into easy boxes. Sean is a kind person with little patience for false enthusiasm. He is a scholar with a wicked sense of humor and a philosopher with a soul. He is a writer who is almost also a priest. And his prose maneuvers a similar paradox. A stagnant teacher at an all-boys prep school with fantasies of becoming an actor, a friendless homeless man with an aura equal parts hope and resignation, a screwdriver guzzling mother with a disrespect for authority, a strip club bouncer with a broken face. His characters are bizarre in their normalcy. They churn through the commonplaces of our world, seeing life in ways complicated by love, loneliness, and faith. They are rooted in our reality, yet the work they do somehow moves us closer towards the mystic, and they render a strange and lasting tenderness. In a story titled Jesus and Blueberry Cobbler, Sean writes, "We sleep alone in cold beds, staring out from the windows at a moon as alone as ourselves. And though we believe Jesus is with us, the wooden figurine hanging over our desks is a far cry from the heat of another person, a body, a hand across the small of our backs. Those are the difficult times, the dark nights of the soul." Sean Taui has published work in World Riot, The Rumpus, The Newer York, and elsewhere. He is working on a PhD here at FSU. He serves as the fiction editor for Bluestem magazine at Eastern Illinois University. For 4 years, Sean was training to become a Catholic priest. It didn't work out. He arrived in Tallahassee via Tacoma, God's Country, Washington, and St. Louis, Missouri. And I have a feeling that my fancy words may be too fluffy for his taste, so I'll describe it one more time this way. Sean writes the sad, Sean writes the funny. It is good. Lean in close. Please join me in welcoming Sean Taui to the warehouse stage.
I really wish that was the first time someone's called me vaguely smug. It is not. It is far, far from the first time that's happened. Thank you very much, Colleen, and thanks everyone for being here. I know it's midterms and crazy, so I appreciate the time. I'm going to read a short story here. And as Colleen mentioned, I'm Irish. My family's Irish. I lived there until I was four. And coincidentally, this is a story about an Irish matriarch dying of cancer. And again, totally random, right? My own grandmother passed away of cancer 5 years ago at the end of this month. So I do just want to say that this one is for Kate. It's called Extreme Unction. The green overhead signs in Dublin International Airport were written in English and Irish Gaelic, one on top of the other, words I understood below what to me constituted random groupings of vowels and consonants and accent marks. Dad tried to teach me Irish one summer. The only thing I remembered was that there were no words for yes or no, which struck me as a pretty basic thing to overlook. I took the train to Dalkey and then down Castle Street. Everything was still wet and made of stone. I peered inside the windows of O'Connell's Books, where Gran worked for 35 years, half expecting to see her behind the counter reading Crime and Punishment because she loved the Russian authors best, a cigarette resting between her fingers, glasses perched halfway down her nose. Doctors had discovered tumors in her pelvis and left femur. The cancer's presence in her bones meant it had originated elsewhere, maybe her liver, and grown undetected long enough to render useless all but the most invasive treatments, which Gran had declined. She was going to die on her own terms. Next to O'Connell's was the King's Inn, which played host to my first and only experience of being overly inebriated. I was 17, staying with Gran by myself for a couple of weeks. I told Gran I was going for a walk, which wasn't a total lie because I did walk the four blocks to the pub. I was a year under the official drinking age, and everyone knew the trick to getting served underage was confidence. I stormed into the King's Inn like I was taking hostages. The bartender was leaning against the back wall, arms folded across his chest, white towel hanging from his elbow. I slammed my money down on the bar. "One Guinness," I said. A lone man was casually watching television while three women sat at a table near the back. They all turned to look at me. "Jesus, my Yanks are fucking loud," said one of the women. One Guinness turned into two Guinnesses, which turned into three Jameson and Cranberries, which turned into me talking to the bartender about how everyone loved my older brother more than me in a horrific Irish accent. And then Gran, all 5 feet, 2 inches of her, came through the door, grabbed me by the ear, and pulled me off of my stool. "He still owes me 20 quid," said the bartender. "Good luck and fuck you," said Gran. She dragged me all the way home. Once we got inside, she stood and stared at the floor. She didn't yell or hit me, even though the broom was right there by the door. She was disappointed, and it hurt so much worse. "Jimmy, promise me you'll never do that again," she said. "Promise me you'll not end up like your grandfather." I was a little dizzy, but from the drinks or the guilt, I couldn't tell. "I promise," I said. Gran's California King took up 80% of her room. Aunt Eva, Dad, and I orbited around its perimeter, Gran a tiny sliver of a person in a sea of sheets. The medication and years of drinking homemade wine had turned her face beefy and red. She wore wire-rimmed glasses and had hair like straw. "How are things in St. Louis?" she asked me. "Pretty good," I said. "I made Salesman of the Month in September." "Kieran played a show in St. Louis a year ago," said Dad. "I flew out there to see him with Jimmy. He was great." "Only time you've been to St. Louis," I added. "When is Kieran coming over?" asked Aunt Eva. Even if my older brother Kieran had not been an up-and-coming rock star, I would have been used to fielding questions about him, seeing as he managed to sneak away and do either drugs or young women at every family function. It was hard not to feel like my own presence wasn't quite good enough, like I was a shadow without the corresponding light. I was about to tell Aunt Eva that he was on tour, that there was no chance of him making it to Dublin, when Dad said, "He'll be here any day." "How do you know?" I asked. Dad leaned over and touched his toes, and then he wrapped his fingers around his ankles. Back in Tacoma, he worked part-time as a yoga instructor and carpenter. He had been staying with Gran for the past 2 weeks. "I just know," he said. I lit Gran's cigarette for her. They came in purple and white boxes and inhaled like nothing at all. A rooster a couple of backyards away screeched at the noon sun. "I wish that rooster would get cancer," said Gran. I looked down at her hands, and her fingers were hopelessly frail, the veins as clear as highways on a map. And Eva wrestled with the window, which wouldn't open all of the way. She banged on the wooden frame with her fist. "Stupid fucking thing," she said. "Nothing works right in this house." And Eva was threatening to sue the doctors for not catching the cancer earlier. I watched her reflection through the window until I felt Gran touch my hand. "I think it's fabulous about you being Salesman of the Month," she said. "Thanks, Gran," I said. We assumed Gran was delirious because surely, after all those years, she didn't want a priest in the house. "Confession," she said. "I need the last rites." It sounded like a horrific operation, and I imagined a room full of brains and clear glass vats. Aunt Eva, Dad, and I traded worried looks. "I'll get you some morphine, Ma," said Dad. "Right," said Aunt Eva. "It's time for that." "I'm not joking," she said. "Get a priest." The next morning, the fourth day of my week-long trip, I went downstairs to get some coffee. The front part of the house, called the New Addition, was built in the late 19th century, while the original part of the house, including the staircase I was carefully navigating, hailed from the 18th century. There wasn't a right angle within 3 miles. A dropped coin rolled into dark crevices and disappeared. I heard Aunt Eva and Dad arguing in the front room, and I eavesdropped on them from the kitchen. "Who cares if she wants to see a priest?" said Dad. "It's her choice." "All I'm asking is why," said Aunt Eva. "Those priests were fucking awful to us, Colin, and the nuns, too. Do you remember when Sister Cecilia, the fat cunt, spit on the sidewalk as Mum walked by? I still think it was coincidental." "Shut up," she said. "It only got worse after you left." I kind of sort of knew the story. My grandfather abandoned the family when my dad was 10 years old, but Gran didn't go to the church and beg for forgiveness, admit that she was somehow the cause for her husband's sinful behavior. She never made Aunt Eva or Dad get their first communion or confirmation. In 1970s Dublin, she was nothing short of heretical. Dad told me that his father drank himself to death, and that was it. "We're all our own anchors, Eva," said Dad. "Shut the fuck up, will you?" said Aunt Eva. "Fucking anchors. What the fuck are you going on about?" What he was going on about was Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now, which Dad read after his software company at Tacoma went under in the market crash of 99. He also grew a beard and a ponytail. "We still haven't talked about selling the house," he said. "I'm thinking about opening up a spirituality center. It would focus on the meditation of woodworking." Aunt Eva walked into my kitchen hideout, clenching her jaw. She wore black jeans and her dark curly hair in a bun. I focused all of my attention on my cup of coffee. "Jimmy, go find a priest for your grandmother," she said. I looked up at her, confused. She was a history professor in England and hated religion. "Where should I go?" I asked. She exhaled, closed her eyes, rubbed her temples. Dad could have that effect on people. "I don't know, Jimmy," she said, "but if I were you, I might start at a church." St. Mary Star of the Sea Parish was hideous. It looked like the love child of the 1960s and a mermaid. The walls were painted light blue and the carpet was a nauseous marine green. A floor-to-ceiling poster featured a depiction either of Jesus or one of the Doobie Brothers. The fish imagery registered loud and clear, complete with actual fishing nets hanging on either side of the crucifix, giving the impression that Jesus was into sadomasochism. I should have guessed it would be my job to hunt down a priest. I was the only one in the family who abided by common laws and morals. I was a straight B student through every stage of my academic career. I majored in business. I did not have any minors. I worked in advertising, and I did well enough to pay for a spur-of-the-moment trip to Ireland. On the freeway, I went 5 over the speed limit. The other people in my family wanted to leave their indelible marks on the planes of human consciousness. I was trying to make it medium, not entirely unnoticed nor overly celebrated. I expected the priest to be like Philip Seymour Hoffman from Doubt or the chubby red-haired guy from Gran Torino. In my head, Catholic priests were like alien species. Some were nice and shared valuable information. Others raped children. "Can I help you?" a man asked. He wasn't wearing a priest shirt. "Probably not. I need a priest." "Father Chris Couture," he said. Father Chris wore a green button-up shirt, khakis, and Birkenstocks. He was bald with closely cropped white hair covering the sides of his head. He wore glasses. "Beautiful church here," I said. "Americans are terrible liars," said Father Chris. "I'm assuming you're not here to talk about architecture." I told him about Gran. Father Chris jumped back and steadied himself against one of the wooden pews. "Jesus H. Christ," he said. "Dolores Waters asking for a priest." I didn't know how to respond. I considered telling Father Chris that he shouldn't take the Lord's name in vain, but then I figured I shouldn't tell a priest what to do with the Lord's name. He whistled through his teeth. "I'll be by as soon as I can," he said. I had to walk by the train station on my way back home. I turned the corner down Castle Street, past the coffee shop that sold real American lattes, and then I saw my older brother smoking a cigarette. "Holy shit," I said, "Kieran." He looked up at me and smiled. He was the lead singer of an alt-country band called Walk the Buffalo. His bolo tie dangled down his flannel shirt and his tan cowboy hat hung back on his head. He began his music career singing for a reggae band, and back then he had white boy dreads and 20 tie-dye t-shirts. He still smoked a ton of pot. "What's going on, little brother?" he said. "I didn't know you were coming." "I accidentally ran over our rhythm guitarist with the van," he said, "so the tour's off for a little while." It was a typical Huron story, egregious incompetence followed by total and utter avoidance of responsibility. "Is the guy all right?" I asked. "Who?" "The guitar player, Huron." He finished his cigarette and tossed it to the pavement. "Chucky Todd? He's fine. Pair of broken legs. How's Gran?" "If she were any better, she'd be twins," I said in a mock Irish accent. He offered me his bag as we walked toward Gran's. I tried not to hate myself for taking it from him. Curon basked in the attention bestowed upon him. It had been a year since I'd seen him. He sang Whiskey in the Jar for Gran, and Eva said she gave out his album, Mending Fences, to all of her friends in Bristol. Walk the Buffalo had recently played on The Tonight Show, but the episode hadn't aired yet. Jimmy Fallon's totally awesome, he said. We smoked a joint together. You smoked pot with Jimmy Fallon, asked Dad. He got real stoned, man, said Curon. He started doing impressions of cats doing impressions of dogs. It was awesome. I smiled with the rest of my family, tried to force myself to feel happy for my brother. It wasn't that I was jealous of Curon. It was that the guy had spent his entire life in a ray of fucking sunshine. I always knew Curon would make it, said Aunt Eva. Do you have any photos, I asked, on your phone? Curon looked over at me and then winked at Dad. Yeah, Jimmy, he said. They let you take photos when you're smoking pot with Hollywood stars. Everyone laughed at my lack of cool. The more time I spent with my family, the more I was glad I had moved to St. Louis, to the Midwest, where exceptionalism was a mortal sin. My family didn't understand that I was the unorthodox one. I practiced sincerity and humility. I was trying to find the median. In a family full of hippies and rock stars, I was the real rebel. I would shatter their minds with normalcy. I wasn't going to sleep very well because I had to share a bed with Curon, who had a tendency to sprawl out. At least it was a queen. Sleeping with clothes on causes cancer, he said as he stripped down. I was grossed out, but I also noticed that he was in better shape than me. He reached into his pants pocket and pulled out a box of Gran's morphine. He swallowed a pill without water. This is some medical-grade shit, he said. I rolled over and shut my eyes. Curon snored the entire night, which at least covered up the 300-year-old groans the house made, wooden beams and iron joints expanding as the night air cooled. I woke up early, got out of bed, and went downstairs. Dad was already up, drawing on legal paper at the kitchen table. A yoga mat was rolled out on the floor. I poured myself a cup of coffee and sat down next to him. Morning, son, he said. I bet you're glad to be with your older brother. What are you working on, Dad? He was sketching out plans for a longhouse, complete with a hut for Native American sweats. At the top of the page, he had written, The Irish Woodworking Spirituality Center. Do you remember the old smelter that they blew up years ago in North Tacoma, he asked. Well, they've cleaned up all the pollution, and now they're selling the land. Hardly anything grows that orange out there anymore. How are you going to get the money, I asked. Believe it or not, this old house is worth over $1 million. He went back to drawing on the legal pad. Of course Dad was going to inherit hundreds of thousands of dollars and then waste it before he had a chance to die and pass it on to me. And of course Curon was going to be a morphine-using rock star with an actress wife. And Jesus Christ, it was all such a fucking disaster because nobody gave a single fuck about Curon dying or Gran dying in her king-sized bed, or me, for that matter. You know, Dad, I said, you could always think about saving the money. That way Curon and I would inherit it someday. Dad looked at me with disgust. She's my mother. I'll do whatever I want with the money, he said. Besides, you and Curon will inherit the Spirituality Center. Father Chris showed up later that morning. He looked like he had dressed himself inside a homeless shelter's free clothes closet. His black pants were a little big, and the extra fabric was folded over the belt he cinched around his waist. He held a small black briefcase. Hello, James, he said when I answered the door. Then he met Dad. You must be Colin, said the priest. Nice to meet you, Father, said Dad. Neither Dad nor I knew the standard social protocol regarding priests. It was like meeting a genocide survivor. I kept thinking, this man doesn't have sex. We creaked up the steps and into Gran's room. Aunt Eva had combed Gran's hair and dabbed makeup on her cheeks. Curon had just showered and he stood in the hallway, dripping water on the floor, a towel wrapped around his waist. How are you, Dolores, said Chris. I hear you're in the mood for confession. Yes, Father, she said. Would you like some tea? Which was just like Gran, to offer someone tea as she lay dying. He declined and patted her hand and then pulled the briefcase onto his lap and opened it. He removed a long, rectangular piece of purple cloth. He kissed it and placed it over his shoulders. He put the briefcase back down. So, confession is a bit private, you know, he said. And Eva, Dad, and I all jumped from our spectating positions and bustled out of the room, muttering apologies, closing the door behind us. We found ourselves standing on the landing with Curon. We looked at each other, and then Dad took a small step toward the door and leaned forward, ear first. Get the fuck downstairs, said Aunt Eva, all of ye. Curon, Dad, and I made our way toward the kitchen, Aunt Eva staring at us the entire time. Dad and I were watching soccer in Gran's room. I was going to miss her house, even if I barely knew it, maybe because I barely knew it. As kids, our Irishness set Curon and me apart. It made us special. We proclaimed our ancestry far and wide, and when the other kids talked about how their great-great-grandmother came from Cork, we'd say our actual grandmother lives in Dublin right now. Colin, I have a request, said Gran. What, do you want to see an archbishop, asked Dad. Sure, we'll get the Pope himself to pay a visit. I want to go have a drink, said Gran. I'll get you a drink, said Dad. I'll have one with you, I said. Gran shook her head so hard her glasses fell off her face and landed on the pillow. She kicked her feet up and down. I want to go to the pub. Gran was bedridden, and Eva had to hold her over a bedpan to take a shit. She was in no condition for a Friday night at the King's Inn. At that moment, Curon chimed in. He had overheard the conversation from the hallway. I'll take you out for a drink, Gran. I'll dance with you all night. You're such a charmer, Curon, she said. Tell Eva to come up here and help me get ready. So there we were, the day before I was flying back to St. Louis, standing in the living room, all done up for a Friday night at Docky's Finest Pub. Gran looked gorgeous in her purple dress, even if it hung loose because of all the weight she had lost. Aunt Eva put a bow in Gran's hair, and Curon had managed to find clothes that didn't reek of pot. I still think this is a terrible idea, said Aunt Eva. What if you get hurt? I'm dying of cancer, said Gran. It took us a while to get to the King's Inn, even though it was only four blocks away. The cobblestones jostled Gran's wheelchair, and she bit her lip instead of yelling out from the pain. When we finally did get to the pub, four or five career drunks sat at the bar, searching for solace in honey-colored depths. It was more or less like I remembered it. Natural light fought its way through cracks in the door frame and holes in the curtains. A middle-aged bartender with patchy reddish facial hair polished glasses. Everyone turned and stared at Gran in her wheelchair and Curon in his stupid fucking cowboy hat. What are we having, I asked. Whiskey, said Curon, Dad, and Aunt Eva. I'll have a nice Chardonnay, said Gran. I brought the drinks over to the table where they had wheeled Gran in a corner underneath a framed poster of the Guinness toucan, a pint balanced precariously on his beak. We talked about everything except cancer. At first, I was disappointed that there weren't more people in the bar, that we weren't having a giant party, that there wasn't an all-Ireland announcement that my dying grandmother was holding court at the King's Inn. But then I noticed how Gran looked at us. She was proud. The bar filled up, and Curon danced with every woman who had led him, and I watched him from the table. Dad and Aunt Eva talked to some friends at the other end of the bar. Gran and I were the only people in the family comfortable with silence, content to play witness to our surroundings. I wanted to tell her that I had read every book she sent me, from the mystery series The Secret Seven to The Lord of the Rings to the complete Kafka she mailed to me at college. I wanted to tell her thank you. Do you want to know what I confessed, Jimmy? She asked Gran. You don't have to tell me, I said. She'd had two glasses of wine, but she hadn't touched the shot of whiskey a kind stranger left for her on the table. She grabbed me by the collar and pulled me close to her. I killed your grandfather, she said. I was expecting something along the lines of a scandalous affair with a public official. I finished her whiskey. Gran, I don't think you're feeling so good, I said. I didn't kill him, she continued. He was running drugs for the IRA. When he left us, he ran off to Paris with wads of their money. Paul was always an idiot. They found him, but he'd already spent everything. Then they called me and said they wouldn't kill him if I came up with the money. Jesus, I said. I told them I didn't have it. She wiped away a few tears. She turned and looked at Dad and Aunt Eva. They waved. Wait, I said, you did have the cash? No, of course not. Half the time I was worried the children would starve, she said. But I could have tried harder. I could have borrowed the money. They shot him in the head. You're the only person I've told. You and the priest. Before I could say anything, Curon came up to the table and grabbed Gran's wheelchair. He spun her around. Thin Lizzy's The Boys Are Back in Town played in the background. Time to dance, Gran, he said. You two are looking way too sad. Be careful, Curon, I said. I'm always careful. Let's do some forgetting. And then he wheeled Gran out to the middle of the floor to cheers and raise glasses. Dad and Aunt Eva joined them, and then I got up from the table as well, and we spent the rest of the night dancing around her like she was the bride at a beautiful, beautiful wedding. I woke up the next morning feeling like 10 pounds of shit in a 9-pound bag. I didn't even bother folding my clothes as I stuffed them into my suitcase. Gran wasn't going to live much longer, and I wouldn't be able to fly back for the funeral, so it was my last goodbye, and I felt like I had to make some sort of Hollywood-quality last statement. Love you, Gran, I said, and then she said, I love you too, James, and that was it. I hugged everyone, and I was thankful to be hungover because it kept my mind off Gran's imminent death. I even accepted a morphine pill from Curon. My head felt normal-sized again by the time the cab dropped me off at the airport. I slept for most of the journey. I woke up in time to see St. Louis appear. The plane circled around the arch, the Mississippi winding past it. And there was a man in a suit and tie sitting next to me who stank like 3 days of no sleep and coffee, and a woman with giant middle-aged Midwestern hair in front of me scrolling through photos of her grandchildren on her phone, and it was a Boeing 737 full of constantly receding horizons. That was when I understood why Gran received confession. The only way to carry the weight was to share it. I didn't plan on telling my family about my grandfather. And maybe Dad would build his Irish longhouse, and maybe Curon would reach national stardom, and maybe it would all fail. But what I had was special, too. I had a piece of grand story. I carried the weight. Thank you.